changed it again, what, 80 years later. When I say he failed at everything, he managed to get General Smuts, who was the general at the time. I know we're supposed to be talking about Akhenaten, but I got involved with this one. General Smuts, who was the head of the government at the time, finally, after in 1914, he had a march from Newcastle. And he got all the miners from Newcastle to march through the Orange Free State, and they crossed the border. There was a rule that the Indians and the Africans could not cross borders. They had to live in certain locales. And basically, what they did is it wasn't even that big a march, by about 3,000 people. 3,000 people crossed the border. They had to put them all, they couldn't put them in jail. They couldn't, this is hard to realize that this is something that, but in 1913, this was such a radical idea that they actually had to negotiate and change a lot of the laws about living in certain areas, about laws against being married, about owning property, this kind of thing. Well, Gandhi went to India in 1914. As soon as he left, they changed all the laws back. It got even worse, as we know. But at any rate, with Akhenaten, the idea about that was interesting about Akhenaten was that it was about the introduction of monotheism. Well, I say, well, I don't really know if he was... We don't really know. There's so much we don't know about Akhenaten. I had read a book by Velikovsky and a book by Freud. The book by Freud is Moses of Monotheism. Probably you know that one. The Velikovsky one is called Oedipus and Akhenaten, in which he proposes the very intriguing idea that Oedipus, that Akhenaten was a kind of model on which the story of Oedipus was drawn. And my original opera, by the way, was called Oedipus and Akhenaten, and I had the idea to do a double opera with the story of Oedipus and the story of Akhenaten going on kind of at the same time. And what happened was that the story of Akhenaten got so interesting that I just got rid of the Oedipus. He just couldn't stand up to it. Akhenaten was a fabulous character. And I just got rid of Oedipus. That was commissioned by the Stuttgart Opera and also by the Houston Grand Opera, and it was performed in both. Again, I had two different interpretations of the same piece, which was something I tried to do at that point. I like the idea of doing two interpretations at the same time, because we sometimes get the idea with contemporary opera that when you see one production, you've seen the opera. In point of fact, it's only through many interpretations of an opera that we actually begin to understand what they're about. That we have to see them many times. We have to look at them in different ways. We have to try them out in different ways. So that finally, after 2 zillion performances of Carmen, there is now a cultural image of Carmen that we all share. So that when someone does a Carmen, we know who Carmen is. We know what the opera is, and if Peter Brook does a Carmen, then we begin to, it moves that around, it pushes it in some way. But it becomes, so interpretation is important. I think, a mistake to think that the original artists or composers have any final idea, that they have very, in fact, it's important to remember that when we do a piece, we're doing it for the first time, we barely know it ourselves. Well, you know, our interpretive, the first thing we're trying to do when we're putting on a new opera is just to get the damn thing on the stage, get it to work, get the curtain to come up and come down at the right time, to have people not running into each other. You just get that to happen. That's almost an accomplishment. To talk about an interpretation of a new work is actually not possible. It's really only after we've learned to work over a period of time. So my idea with these operas was to have several productions at the beginning, which was a signal that there could be, and there have been, other interpretations. With Akhenaten has been done again in Sweden. It was done, it's going to be done next year in Turin in Italy. So it's happening with some of those pieces. Maybe I answered that. I answered that question more or less. Is there, yeah. Yes. Well, you know, the audience laughs, actually. The audience laughs. All the jokes are still there, and I hear them, and they come every night in the same places. you know. So I know that it's in the, like when the ears move, you'll see. You know, the ears move, everyone laughs. Humor, in a way, Orfe is almost the funniest one. It's there are very funny things that happen in Orfe. Cocteau had his great gift was to talk about very serious things, and there's this, and at the same time, the addition, the humorous parts of it really add to it tremendously. Though I sometimes say that the first opera is the it's a kind of a comic transcendent opera. The second opera, the one we're going to see tomorrow, is a romantic opera. The third one, Les Enfants Terribles, is the tragic one. No doubt, that's what it is. It's like a Greek tragedy. It's to me, it's the most. I can't wait to start it. It's a fantastic story. I've been very lucky to have I think I've had probably the best librettist I've ever had in my life, and it wasn't so hard to do. I went to Paris and I went to the Cocteau estate and I spoke to the people there, and they were into it. The funny thing with Lavelle, which I forgot to mention, which I'll mention now, is that in order to get the rights to not use the music of Aurique, I had to go. I had to get the rights from his family. And I was in Nice doing a concert, his widow was there, and I went to see her. And I said to her, and she was curious about what I was going to do. I said, well, I'm going to turn off the soundtrack, and I've written another one. I've written a score, and we're performing it as an opera with the film. And she was a little not so, and then I said to her, I pointed out to her, I said that when we had done Orfe in Boston, a movie house, and it was in Cambridge, actually, nearby ran the film for the whole period that the opera was running, for 2 months. And they said that not only was I not dismembering the work of her husband, because in fact I haven't removed it from the film, I've simply turned the sound off, but that we were honoring, because there would be more viewings of the original film now as a result of the opera. This argument has the virtue of being truthful, because, in fact, that is what happens. People go back to the film. And I don't have the rights to what they call to mechanically synchronize the music with the film. In other words, that means I can't remix the film with my music. I have the rights to perform it live. Other questions? I am too.
First question is, have you written the comedy? Second question is, not really.
Oh, yes, I will. I'll answer the second question first. I have a plan. I'm going to, in the next couple years, I want to set some of the Canterbury Tales, which are extremely funny and very dirty. Well, there are a lot of fart jokes and things like that. Do you know the Canterbury Tales? They're very funny, and I want to do the Miller's Tale first. So I'm very interested in comedy. I think comedy is the highest form of theater. I think it's the most difficult form. I think there's a very good reason why Verdi waited until he was 83 to write his first comic opera, and Falstaff, which of course is a great work. I don't know if I can. I don't trust the state of the country to wait till I'm 83 to write a comic opera. I better write it while I'm alive. I don't think I may not have a chance later. I have waited. In fact, I think it takes everything. It will take everything I know about theater and about music to write a comic opera. I think it's the most. It is the most challenging form. There's no doubt about it. I think tragedies are fairly. They're fairly simple in terms of the timing, in terms of the development, in terms of how the structures work. With comedy, the form is much more free, and it's much more spontaneous. You don't have a tragic form. You don't have a comic form the way you have a tragic form, for example. That's one indication of why there's some... where the focus of a story is, and where the focus of the character is much more difficult to determine with a comedy. Whereas with a tragedy, if the tragedy is Othello, we know who the bad guy is. You know, we know it's easy to figure out. With comedy, it's much harder to figure out. I think that one of the things that was very helpful for me as a composer is I've done a lot of Shakespeare plays. I've done a lot of music for Shakespeare plays at the Public Theater. And I've learned more about theater from Shakespeare than anybody. He was, the way I found, I would get a play like Henry V and I would try to read it, and I would find it, I couldn't, when I tried to read it on the page, I could hardly get through it. But as soon as an actor got up and began to speak the parts, it came alive. And I saw that Shakespeare was about living theater, that was totally about that, and that his comedies. And we did Henry IV, Henry IV 1 and 2, that's the one, that is the one with Falstaff in it. And there are comic scenes throughout. And I've actually had to write music for, I had to do my own Falstaff music in those pieces. Now, how I dealt with it in this piece, I mean, there are funny things that happen, but my intention in the film, in the operatic presentation I'm doing, was not in fact to actually kind of Mickey Mouse the movie. What I've really done, I think, is transform this movie into something else, which is like an opera with film. So I did not consider that I had to. In fact, my interpretation of the work is quite different from Cocteau's in a certain way. I mean, not quite different, but there are things that are different. There are things that I can do in the music that don't happen in the original, in the film. What? Oh, I'm glad you asked. I will tell you. this brings up the whole thing about what the film is about, in a way. This innocent, seemingly innocent question. It's an allegorical film. I mean, on the one hand, it's a fairy tale in a way. It's a great love story, like Romeo and Juliet. We know. Do we all know the story? Or I don't have to do that. Okay. So on one level, on the first level, it is a love story. On in my view, the film is really for Cocteau. An opportunity, as most of his work was, to investigate what the creative process is. The process of creativity is the subject of Cocteau's work. You'll see it in The Blood of a Poet, and you'll certainly see it in Orfeu, which is easier to see because, admittedly, I mean, the film is about immortality and art and love and death, all those good things together. So we can see that that's what it's about. At one point, in Orfeu, if you remember, when the princess who plays the part of death is about to send Orfeu back to his wife, so that she was going to undo all the events of the opera or the film. And Eltebis, who is her assistant, we know the film well enough. Eltebis, who is her assistant, says, she says, we have to send him back through time. We have to make what happened not happen. And Eltebis says to her, but you can't, this is the one thing we can't do. By the way, Stephen Hawking agrees that that's the one thing we can't do. If you've read the book, I read the book and I found out. That's the only thing I did find out. But that the arrow of time points in one direction, and as Hawking would say, and Eltebis says to Princess, but you can't. This is the one thing you can't do. And she says this beautiful line. And one of the things that's so wonderful about Cocteau is that the writing is so beautiful. And she says to him, in order for a poet to become immortal, a sacrifice has to be made. And that is the mechanism by which his immortality is obtained. And the film, Orfeu, is about that. Now, in the same way, that the subject of La Belle is about creativity. It's hard not... I have to say that I saw it many times where I began to see that there was something else very much going on. When I saw the father going at the beginning, the father goes to the forest and he ends up at the chateau. It's very hard after a while not to see that is the journey through the unconscious. The chateau is the site of creativity. And what do we find in the chateau? We find this half man, half beast, this And what is his, and what he wants to do is to escape from this, or to transform himself into the transcendent figure of this prince at the end. Now, again, right away we're pointing right away to the heart of the piece, which is about transformation. But not only the transformation of the prince, of the beast into the prince, the kind of half human into the transcendent figure, but also it's the transformation of the world of appearance to the transcendent world, which is actually the subject of what Cocteau was really dealing with. Now, later in the film, it's so clear, he even gives you a recipe. At one point, you'll see the beast says to Lebel, he's pointing to his treasure, and he says, this is my treasure, and everything I have here is through the power of magic. He says, and my magic comes through five elements. I think someone mentioned the glove. Who did? Did you? He said the elements are the horse, the key, the rose, the mirror, and the glove. These are all elements that we see in the movie. The horse is the horse that carries the father home. The mirror, they look through from one world to the other. The key was the key to the treasure. And it's clear that this is the formula his power is there, but it's not complete. If it were complete, he wouldn't be the beast. But so even with these elements, it's incomplete. So what we have? We have the horse that represents strength and determination. We have the key that represents technique. We have the rose that represents beauty. We have the mirror that represents wisdom and transcendence. And the glove, which is the most interesting, and I was puzzled by the glove. I don't think, though there is a funny scene, and people do laugh. But I was puzzled by the glove for a while, and then I realized that the glove represents nobility, that this is the truest state of the artist. And yet, there is an element missing, and the element missing is the element of love. And until, in fact, when Lebel learns to love the prince, when learns to love the beast, when she gives him what she calls the look or the glance of love, then by that look of love that he becomes transformed. It happens at the very end of the movie. And we have a beast with a problem, basically. And he's stuck in the chateau. He has all the magic at his disposal, and yet he can't, he's in this enchanted place, and all his magic is not able to bring about his transformation. And the father turns up, and I think not by accident does he turn up, but that's just a suspicion of mine. I can't prove that contextually in the film, though everything else I can. And but if you look at the scene, now, tomorrow when you see it again, or if you see it later, or whatever, there's a scene where the beast comes into the garden, and he says, "You've stolen my rose, and because of this, you're going to die." You know, this is the first encounter with the beast. And the father falls and says, "Well, I just took the rose to take home to my daughter." And he says, "Daughters," he said, "how many do you have?" And he says, "I have three." And then a very interesting thing begins to happen. It's very clear now that the beast needs that daughter. He wants the daughter to replace. He's not interested in killing the father. That's just a bluff. Basically, he wants the daughter. He knows the daughter is there. He's always known the daughter was there. And he has to get the daughter to come to the chateau. It's without the element of love, he'll be trapped there forever. And it's Lebel will bring that love. But not in its first form. When she first arrives, and I'll get back to the scene in a second. When she first arrives, he asks her every night to marry him, and she refuses. So this kind of possessive love is not the love that's required, and it doesn't work. Finally, she says, "I have to go home to see my father. My father's dying." And he says, "Okay, you can come home, but you have to come back in 7 days. And if you don't come back," and he says to her, "if you don't come back, I will die, and all this treasure will be yours, and you don't have to do anything." So he knows that she's going to come back. this becomes the love of generosity, where he's willing to give up. He is basically giving up his own life. He knows he's not going to come back, and he does die. And that is the love that becomes the love that transforms. So it's not just any old love, mind you. It's got to be this special love, the love of a generous heart. That becomes the sixth element, and by which the transformation can take place. But now we're back at the garden. And the beast says to him, well, no, you have to die. He said, but perhaps. He said, perhaps. And he looks at him, and take a look at the way he looks at the father. And he says, maybe one of your daughters could replace you, and if she comes in, I will accept her. Well, you know that he needs, this is the plan all along. So now this is how I interpret, this is now, what I'm giving you now is my interpretation of this scene. The beast is playing with the father, he's toying with him. He's going to get the daughter to come, and he's tricking him into bringing the daughter there. So what I do, since that's my interpretation of it, the scene not being, it's partly a scary scene, but it's also something very funny about it. There's something about the beast so what I do is I have a kind of a descending figure in the bass, which is almost kind of like a laugh. It sounds like a laugh to me. And all through that scene, you hear this laugh coming down. And that's what that music is. So in other words, through my interpretation of the film, I saw the scene in a way which wasn't so apparent. Maybe it, for God, who knows, I may be making the whole thing up. Except it's in the movie. And I can show you every place that I've talked about actually in the movie. And so actually, I was talking to a French journalist yesterday in Philadelphia. And he said, well, did you read Madame So-and-so's book about Lebel? I said, no. He said, you didn't, but she explains everything. And I said, who cares? And he said, you're right, who cares? But what's important is not her interpretation or your interpretation, but the fact that I have one that reveals something to me about not only the piece, but about, that's part of it, but it reveals something to me about Cocteau. And that becomes truly interesting, because we talk about how an artist reveals himself through his work, but how does he reveal himself? In which way has he revealed? What has he told us about himself? In fact, Cocteau has told us a lot about how he looks at creativity in this piece. When I say creativity, forget that word. Use the word transformation. Because creativity is kind of a fancy word. You think it's only artists and painters. But transformation is something that we all do. Transformation, when we take the ordinary world and to make the world livable requires transformation. Just to make it bearable requires transformation. So it's something that we all do. We all have to do it. And these are the elements of transformation that he talks about. And they're all there for everybody. It's not just the requirement of the artist. So Cocteau, as an artist, and if you look at his work, he was concerned absolutely about the life of the artist. But if you extend it beyond that, you can see that the elements, the strength, determination, technique, beauty, transcendent wisdom, nobility, love, all those things are necessary for everybody. So in the way that we talk about transforming the world. So the importance, so what Cocteau is really telling us, you see, and I say, it's what we learn from, these works that is important. That a work of art, not only for the viewer, but for the artist who makes the work. For the work of art is a transformative experience. And that's the heart of what Cocteau is talking about. The next one is the tragic version of this, Les Enfants Terribles, which is a whole other story. Is there? Shall we get a final question? It's almost, what time is it? 10 after 9. Yes. Are you trying to go someplace, David? Are you going someplace? Okay.
Do you also indicate what the
to a degree. In fact, actually quite precisely, if you were to see the libretto. Now, one of the first things I found out in this work, I did indicate very specific things that were never carried out. I had two productions. If you look at the libretto, it says that at the end of Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3, we see the funeral of Akhenaten's father. And we see it at different places. In the end of Act 1 is the funeral of the father. We see the funeral, procession. And the end of Act 2, we would see it again further away. And in Act 3, we would see it. So I really thought of the opera, there was another angle to it, which was about the burial of his father, Amenhotep III. Amenhotep III, that was his dad. And I thought the funeral, if you listen to the very first scene after the prologue, the music is for the funeral of Akhenaten, and it's very loud music. Do you remember that? I had spent some time. There's not that much to read. You can read a lot about Egypt fairly quickly because there's not that much. And I read almost everything that was available, certainly about Akhenaten. There's not much about him at all. And I got very interested in the idea of how they treated dead people, how they treated their dead people. One thing that intrigued me was that someone had made the remark that the Egyptians were very much like Americans, or Americans were very much like Egyptians. You know, that it was a very materialist society. You know, there's big pyramids. I mean, that somehow the pyramid was going to just get the damn thing big enough. You know, it would last forever. You know, well, they're still there. It's pretty impressive. But they're 20,000 years, they may not be there. But there's something about, and also that we know that they were painted and the colors that we see are not the, it was a very garish, evidently, what we understand from the way it was done. The great fear that the pharaohs had was that somehow they would die and that the escorts that would come to take the pharaoh would not notice they had died. That this is a great fear. If you read the Tibetan, not Tibetan, I'm sorry. It's very different, very different. You read the Egyptian Book of the Dead, or what they call the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is basically a collection of prayers and incantations for people that are dying. And basically, if you look at it, what they're saying is, lords of death, look at me, don't forget me. Pay attention, I'm dying, I'm ready to go, the big fear is that somehow they're not going to be, that somehow this great pharaoh would die and somehow the lord of death was off doing something else and didn't notice, and he wouldn't get to take his place in the land of the dead where he could live, he have a certain kind of immortality. What are you coming to, taking me away? I haven't finished. Let me finish the story about Akhenaten. Okay. I haven't finished the story about Akhenaten. So what I did, there's a kind of, if you look at that book, you are taking me away. Okay, after this. So if you look at these things that they write, there's this terrible anxiety that they have that somehow they're going to be forgotten. So I decided, if you're going to write music for the funeral, what would it be? It would be very noisy music. You know, it would be music to wake the dead, literally. So the loudest music in the opera comes in the very first scene, and the drums are beating and the chorus singing. And the idea is that, you know, the god of death is sleeping and he hears this music and he ushers the pharaoh in. So the funeral music is, that's the reason for it. But that was part of the whole, in a way, I really wrapped the whole opera in the idea of the funeral. This idea has never been staged the way I wanted to. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? I how can that happen, right? I'm alive, right? And that's what I would say, I'm alive, how can you do this? But I finally decided that what I would do, in order to see Akhenaten the way I wanted to see it, I would have to direct it myself. Evidently, because I couldn't get anyone else to do it. They would say, oh, that's a really good idea, Philip. Let me try something. Now, if you're an opera director, or opera composer, and a director ever says that to you, don't believe them, they're lying. They're not saying, let me try it, they're going to do it. You know, if once they put it on stage, you'll never get back what you wanted to do. That's just a little warning. If there are there any opera composers here? I bet there are. Don't let them do it. Don't say, I have an idea. Let me just try it and see how you like it. If you have an idea, you have to stick. And that was a very young opera composer at the time. It was, I hadn't done very much. It was my third opera. And I never got my funeral. So what I did after that, I decided, I would become an opera director. So I directed a piece called A Thousand Airplanes on the Roof, which some of you may have seen. And it was a monologue piece. It was for one character. And I said, okay, I'll start with a small piece. And I directed the piece. And it was fine, you know. But we toured the piece for about 18 months. And what happened is every 3 months, the actor would leave and take a job in a movie. And I had to teach the same part over again. I taught it to about 6 different actors. And I got completely sick of it. And I said, oh, this is what directors do. And I decided I didn't want to be a director. So I still have yet to see Akhenaten the way I wanted to see it. But I'm not going to go. Becoming a director is really another métier. And to have begun that process of learning, I was willing to begin it. But then once I got into it, I saw it's an enormous amount of work. And I decided, okay, maybe I could be an okay director. But I thought I would probably have a better chance of writing. I have a better chance of making a contribution writing music than directing operas, and I never did it again. But I still have yet to see the Akhenaten that I want to see. One of the things about Lebel, and this will be my last comment before he takes me away, is that with Lebel, I got one of the most beautiful films that you could ever imagine. Not only that, but it's a classic film, it's a beautiful film. So that the whole question of designer and directing and all that became absolutely tertiary. There were some design and directing decisions to make, but they were minor compared to the great gift that we had, which was a completely beautiful work of art. We still had to find a way to integrate it into a live performance, but that was a great bit of luck having that. And I find, you know, the Cocteau was a great librettist as well. I think I have to go someplace. Thank you.
Let me remind you that you're all invited now to the AD White House if you would like to for informal chat with Phil, if you can find him somewhere, and there'll be some refreshments served there, right? So that's why I have to interrupt it now, because we don't want the reception to go on. Phil would probably stay up here for another hour, you know, but so you're all welcome, so please come. Thank you.